The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, July 7th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Catherine Eden, Bloomberg Distinguished Professor in the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University, author of $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Also for members, we have one of those special Matt Leck member surprises. Who knows what it could be? Maybe he's just going to get really crazy and put on some famous speech from, or some hidden tapes. You could do that.
Just some historical selections of Nixon tapes?
If you wanted to, if there was one that
might
you think
be a
is
little
really...
that. Might, we'll see.
You never know with Matt. It's like he's like a black box. You know what I realized? That I didn't even, like... I think you're still probably drunk from the wedding. But I didn't ask, I didn't say to people, I hope you had a good fourth 2 days ago.
It's a lack of patriotism on your part.
Well, it's just a lack of I'm disconnected. I'm disassociated from time because we're recording this for the future. All of the shows are for the future. We put them all in a time capsule. But this is for next week. I forgot to do that. So I hope you all had a fun fourth. I hope I did. I wonder if I barbecued. I wonder what I did. Did I even see any fireworks? Fireworks sort of freaked me out a little bit. Now that I have kids, I let them because they like it. But it used to be when I was young Matt's age, I refused to watch them because I just felt like this is sort of the classic... You know, here we get the sort of, it's supposed to be a facsimile of war, right? I mean, this is what it's supposed to be, except for it's colorful and off at a distance at arm's length. And so I would get bummed out about it. And now the kids like it. And so that's basically, I would say that it describes like 90% of my life. Like things that I was jaded about, now I don't even have the energy to be jaded about it anymore. I will say this. I have never been someone who has appreciated, well, I don't want to say I haven't appreciated a good meal, but the thing is I can be satisfied, or in the past, I should say, I can be satisfied with one meal versus another meal. Like I don't really have the ability to distinguish between really good food and, you know, okay food. And particularly in terms of home cooking. Now, I'm not implying that there's anybody been in my life who's not been a particularly good cook. I think everybody's been a fairly good cook. But I will say this, not all ingredients are created equal, and not all recipes are created equal. And I have learned this from getting Blue Apron. I've told people in the past that I've talked about it. Benjamin, John Benjamin, the voice of the Majority Report, and then he does some other stuff on the side. It's like Archer or whatever it is. I can't even remember the name of that show. As a present, because I guess he was getting Blue Apron, he got me Blue Apron. I don't know if it was like Hanukkah or what. Three meals. And it was delicious. And now we get it every week. I think we would two meals. Sometimes we switch to one. It depends on what we've got going on. But it's great because, A, for four people, it's fairly inexpensive for the quality of the food. And on top of it, it's really, really good. It's for less than 10 bucks a meal. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. When you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. And Blue Apron knows this. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. We had a... I think it was like a cod, and it was bread encrusted, My kids like fish. It's very exciting for me. Meals available this month. Creamy shrimp fettuccine with sautéed green beans and spinach. That sounds amazing. Saul is going to love that. He loves any type of pasta you can slurp up. He loves it. Sweet chili chicken with Tinkerbell peppers. I have no idea what those are, but those sound great. Green beans and jasmine rice. Spiced steak and tomato avocado salad with creamy cone cabbage and red onion slaw. I'm so hungry right now, I can't even believe it. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. Blue, B-L-U-E, apron, APRON.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Catherine Eden. Just a reminder, tomorrow, I'm not even sure what we're going to be doing. We either have a pre-recorded or we're going to be live, but you'll find out then. Hopefully I've had an opportunity to sit down with somebody in person. You'll find out tomorrow who it is. But if not, maybe I'll be on the phone with somebody. I just don't know. Please stop pressuring me. All right, quick break. When we come back, Catherine Eden. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Catherine Eden. She is a professor of the Bloomberg Distinguished Professor at Johns Hopkins University. She is also author of many books, including her most recent, co-authored with Luke Schaefer, $2 a Day Living on Almost Nothing in America. Welcome to the program, Catherine.
Thanks so much.
So let's start with, I guess, first, how you came about to start this work. You were you had worked on and have spent, decades now studying people living in poverty. And in 97, you published Making Ends Meet, How Single Mothers Survive Welfare and Low-Wage Work. And my understanding is it was the sort of the work that you revisited from that time that ultimately led to $2 a Day.
Yeah, so the book, Making Ends Meet, was really about how single mothers navigated the old welfare system prior to welfare reform. And, you know, back in those days, welfare was an entitlement. If you were income eligible, you got it. It touched the lives in the late 1980s of about 8 in 10 poor families with children. So it's a very robust program, although, as we documented, it still didn't pay enough to survive. And what our book was really about is a very in-depth account of the budgets of poor single mothers. So I spent my 20s, you know, going around the country with my colleague Laura Lane, asking single mothers about their budgets. And you know, after welfare reform, I went on and studied other things. I studied the family life of the poor. So it wasn't until 2010 when I I was teaching at Harvard and I had come to Baltimore to study a group of very disadvantaged young people who had been born in Baltimore's public housing and now were sort of transitioning into adulthood, that I began to encounter a lot of people who, you know, in the old days would have been on welfare, which was renamed TANF after welfare reform or temporary assistance to needy families. And I'll never forget the day I met Ashley. She lived in the Latrobe Homes, one of our public housing complexes, kind of sitting in the shadow of the Baltimore jail. And what was so striking about Ashley is that I came to her house and she greeted me at the door and, you know, she was visibly unkempt. She had this 2-week-old baby, and as she passed the baby from shoulder to shoulder, you know, she was having a hard time even sort of having, you know, sort of enough oomph to sort of properly support that baby's head. And I soon learned there was no food in the household, virtually no furniture. Three adults and this baby lived in this household. And of course, my calculator kicked in, you know, that I had developed in my 20s. And I began to ask her about her budget and encountered this striking reality that there was no cash. Even though the family had a housing subsidy, there was no cash coming into the household from either welfare or wages. And in fact, the family wasn't on food stamps then either. So it just occurred to me, you know, maybe, underneath all of our noses, because welfare reform had really been judged a success, in the aftermath of welfare reform, as the economy sort of sputtered, because you remember it was passed during that sort of miraculous mid to late 90s economy, a new kind of poverty might have arisen in the United States that was so deep we hadn't even thought to look for it. So that's really the origin story of the research. And I think when we went to the numbers, to nationally representative numbers, to look and see whether Ashley's story was a trend or just an anomaly, we were stunned to see that this is a condition that affected 3.3 million American children at any one time for at least 3 months in a calendar year. So much larger than I think either Luke Schaefer, who's the numbers guy in our partnership and the collaboration, or I had really anticipated.
And before we dig into, you know, what AFDC was and how it changed through welfare reform and some of the other stories, the idea that this was that this level of poverty. I mean, you coined essentially a new designation for what we now call extreme poverty. The fact that no one was aware of sort of this new class, if you will, of poverty. What does that tell us, both in terms of the disconnection that these folks have from private institutions or charitable institutions, and also from the government? I mean, in other words, like, would all of the, regardless of welfare reform, would all of this had sort of escaped people's eyes? Or, I mean, how is it that this grew and it was something that you had to stumble upon rather than, you know, going and looking up data that was that you didn't have to sort of discover?
You know, that's a really good question. And I'm not sure that I would have even picked up on it, you know, had I not been in the homes of people. I mean, and part of it's our growing social divide. You know, we've never been as residentially segregated by income as we are today. And so we just don't encounter one another. You know, I do as a virtue of my work, but even now I think, gee, how lucky was it that I stumbled across Ashley? And then, of course, once I figured out, from the numbers, you know, what the sort of national story was, what we did is we said, well, can we go to four cities where we really don't know anyone and just find these people, you know? Are they real? Even though we see them in the numbers, are they real? So we went to Chicago and then Cleveland and then Appalachia and then the Mississippi Delta. And indeed, they were easy to find in all four locations. So it is interesting. But, you know, I think part of the story about why nobody picked up on this, and there were signs. There were signs, you know, little study here, a little study there, but nobody was really putting it together, is the political rhetoric that the liberals and the conservatives were pursuing, right? The liberals were reeling from conservatives' attack that we launched a war on poverty and poverty won. So the social safety net wasn't working and we should disband it, right? So the liberals, were and are still in a defensive posture saying, well, actually it did. If you count poverty this way, look at how low poverty really is now compared to how it used to be. But so they were really you know, spending a lot of time trying to prove that things had gotten a lot better, and they were right. But what they missed, and what everybody was missing, is that the real story was heterogeneity. You know, once the safety net collapsed, and once what remained of the safety net moved away from the categorically needy to the working poor, it created inequality within the poor that is really unprecedented. You know, and people aren't very good at sort of appreciating heterogeneity. You know, we like to think of the poor as a monolithic group, and that's why we coined the term extreme poor, because we really needed a different term to capture this reality of people really being outside of the scope of the cash safety net.
Yeah. For at least. I want to touch on, I mean, the actual dollar per day disparity is pretty amazing. But this concept of I mean, it's I think people or at least on this program we've talked about the notion of fractal inequality in the context of like the 0.01 wealthiest people versus the 1% or we've heard that term heard of that dynamic in the context of, you know, Davos, where the millionaires are upset that the billionaires get to go to the seventh floor or whatever it is. And on some level, this is sort of a mirror of that, but it sounds like nobody wanted to find these people, and so nobody went looking for them.
Yeah, it's really crazy, right? So just since 2010, just to give you an idea of how dramatic the fall has been, even recently, we should have known something was wrong when the TANF rolls went that low. You know, they fell from about 5 million adults in 1996 to about 1 million adults now. Somebody should have said, wait, poverty hasn't fallen that much. In Cuyahoga County, I love this story because that's one of our sites, and that's the home of Cleveland. Just since 2010, the welfare rolls have fallen from, this is cash welfare, right, from 28,000 in one of the nation's poorest cities to just 1,500. So, of course, something was going on.
Right.
And it is, you know, it's sort of... I feel a little bit the person who discovered something that was completely obvious. It was right there in front of us, but
who associated yeah. with those numbers is going to say we're not actually doing that well, right? I mean, that's the problem there, and particularly because of the relationship between. The way that the state governments can use these funds. So let's go back to the AFDC. This is what, when people talk about cash assistance welfare pre-1996, this is what they're talking about for the most part, correct?
Yeah. That's right.
Okay, so explain to us how that worked. I mean, and
yep.
Because this is, I think, people need to understand, you know, the sort of the conceptual change and the practical changes that were made to fully appreciate how this happened.
Yeah. Well, first I'll say that welfare was a terrible program, and very few of us thought that things could get worse. So. It's an ironic story, but AFDC's benefit, its chief virtue, is that it was an entitlement. It was truly a safety net. It caught you when you fell. If you went into a welfare office, you know, in Chicago, and you brought in your pay stubs and your rent receipts and your utility bills, you had the legal right to walk out of there with a check, or a check would be forthcoming as soon as they verified all of the information. And, you know, over time, the welfare rolls grew, and although most people only used it for a short time, there was a remnant of folks who were really long-term dependent on welfare, and that's kind of what created the controversy. People were very worried that it was undermining work and incentivizing single-parent families and so on. My main critique of of AFDC is it paid too little to survive, which we documented, you know, in that city after city. But it still paid better than work, because this is before we began providing, you know, these tax credits for low-wage workers. Today, it actually pays to go to work rather than stay on TANF, because we really support low-wage work to a degree that we never had before. And this was sort of the good part of welfare reform, the expansion of these tax credits for people who were, you know, quote unquote, playing by the rules of working poor.
So let me just stay there. So when you say that AFDC was a bad program that we never thought could get worse, but it did. But what you're saying is it A, that it didn't provide enough assistance, and almost exclusive from the fact that it didn't, it would penalize you to work. It didn't have like sort of a sliding scale or sort of dynamic with
That's
work
right.
that the earned income tax credit does now. So that, I mean, because there's always going to be, and we should be clear on this, there's always going to be some tiny zone where it's sort of like there's a slight disincentive to work, right? Like, I mean, there's always going to be that zone. You can't really escape that, it seems to me. But the idea is that that when you combine greater cash assistance under AFDC in our imaginary program and then supplement it with a sort of a dynamic between what you're earning at work and what the earned income tax credit, which is basically a payment, right? That's sort of like a reverse tax.
You know, it's kind of striking. So here's one way to think about it. Okay, so we added these tax credits they went into effect in 94. We reformed welfare in 96. So very close in timing. But essentially what happened is low-wage workers under the old rules got nothing from welfare, right? If they worked full-time, full year, they, quote-unquote, made too much money in any state. If they only got part-time work, they maybe could get a few dollars, but for every dollar they earned, they were taxed a dollar in their benefits. Terrible disincentive to work, right? What we essentially did with tax credits is we said, you know that $5,000 or that $3,000 you could have gotten from welfare if you didn't work? We're going to give you that same amount of money if you do work. And it's a really clever design. The more you work, the more you get from the program. So it's actually work-inducing. The premium goes up until you hit this, as you said, you know, there's always a little zone. You hit sort of this threshold, you know, at about $15,000 to $20,000, where you don't, you know, you kind of stay static, and then it very gradually declines. The tail is very long, all the way to $40,000. So the disincentive to work is invisible to people. It's a very, very clever design. But what we did to the welfare then is we said, we're going to end the entitlement. We're going to tell states, hey, we're going to still give you the money. You can pretty much do with it what you please within broad constraints. And what states did is more and more they began to fill state budget holes and fund other goodies that governors love, you know, to provide, like college scholarships with the money. So currently, of that $16.5 billion coming from the federal government to the states, they're spending $11.5 million on other things. Things that governors love, things that are more politically popular. Only $5 billion of that federal block grant going into the pockets of welfare recipients. So what TANF did was create more welfare for the states than welfare for people. And once, you know, a governor or a state government has committed to a series of programs they're funding with TANF, let's say we have a recession. Well, what governor is going to say, oh, wait a minute, I'm using my TANF to pay for my child welfare system. I'll just raise taxes to pay for the child welfare system, and I will, you know, improve, you know, I will take more of the money back for TANF. Well, that's not going to happen, right? So what happened with the recession is that the TANF rolls budged hardly at all. And since then, of course, the story has been much the same, leaving this group of very poor, very vulnerable parents with children with virtually no source of cash.
And so, all right, so just to go over this so that people really understand. So was that, and this is why, well, I should start here. This is why when we hear Republicans mostly raise the idea of block granting any given program, this is why people get nervous about it and
That's
recoil,
correct.
Is because it's basically giving states a free rein to redistribute the money and not actually spend it on what the federal government has given them the money for, essentially. And
right. And you can understand. I mean, states are always in fiscal crisis, or often, not Maryland, but often in fiscal crisis. Governors always want to lower taxes, and they always want to do more things than they have the money for. So creating this flexible fund money is almost an irresistible temptation. But it's even worse than that, because if states actually try to maintain a robust TANF system, the way the block grant is structured, the more TANF you give away, the more you sort of preserve TANF's original purpose, the more regulations and requirements you are under. So the states who are trying to do the right thing are subject to fines. And the best way to sort of avoid these fines is to simply cut the rolls. So states are really under pressure to cut the rolls. It's not just sort of a passive thing where they're taking advantage of a freebie. They're in some ways reacting rationally to an impossible situation.
So, and they're designing their programs in such a way to cut the rolls. So in other words, you can only stay on for X amount of time, or what are the mechanisms in which people are thrown off the rolls or are not eligible to begin with for TANF as opposed to the AFDC? I mean, what...
So, fascinating story, right? Very hard to figure this out. So there are several things. One, like the state of Georgia would be an example, Pennsylvania. You can have really rigorous entry requirements. Require somebody, for example, to do a month of job search prior to even applying for the roles, or several weeks of job search. Well, that policy in Georgia reduced the rolls to almost zero. There's a lot of...
And how do you prove that? Like, how do I prove that I come in? All right, so let's just assume, I mean,
yeah.
Put aside for the moment that there is a sort of an obvious difficulty here, right? Because if I have no money, and my kids are old enough to actually go to school, as opposed to being, let's say, 2 or 3 or 4. I assume there's no universal pre-K in Georgia, so 5. So I've got to provide childcare for these kids. Well, I can't afford to hire anybody. Presumably,
yeah.
I don't have family around, because if I did, the cross-reference, those is sort of, The Venn diagram of people who end up at this extreme poverty probably don't have support from a family on some level, right? And so...
Well, yeah, and then what we learned about family was very interesting. So you might think that if you encountered a spell of extreme poverty, you know, the family would be like the best thing. You know, you fall into the arms of your family. But what we saw with the extreme poor, this is very much to your point, is that they often don't have sort of stable family members to rely on. Instead, they often have sort of loose ties with a collection of individuals, often troubled, and they end up in this, in these repeat perilous double-ups. You know, we were watching families and kids go through this, and we at the same time were reading the research on adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. This is amazing new research that shows if you experience trauma as a child, it follows you throughout the life course in these haunting sort of ways. And it was in these repeat perilous double ups with these sort of, you know, variety of individuals, and the parent was so desperate for a place to stay, she wasn't able to exercise, you know, as much discretion as she would have liked. That kids were exposed to, you know, physical, verbal, and even sexual abuse, and began showing manifestations of real distress. So yeah, exactly. You're in Georgia, and if you do fall into the arms of, you know, your network, it's likely to put your children at risk. So the vulnerability is really quite astonishing.
So, okay. So I need to prove to the state of Georgia that I've been looking for a job for a month. Like, how do I do that? And what are the requirements to do that? I mean, if no one's showing up and is able to prove that, I imagine those requirements are incredibly onerous. But, you know, I mean, on some level, it's obvious, even if you don't even know what the standards are. Like, I don't have money. Yeah. That's actually, I have no way of getting transportation. I don't have, yeah. Maybe I have a cell phone, unlikely. I don't know how I could pay for service. I don't have the internet. I mean, how would I even search for a job? And I imagine I'm living in an area where there's not a lot of jobs. I mean, like, not even literally.
It's very difficult. But, you know, these sort of diversion programs like George's are really only a small part of the story. The biggest part of the story is that people aren't even coming to Tana's doors. So to give you a couple of examples, when we asked Travis and Jessica Compton, who are this desperately poor couple who, you know, their hours had both been reduced to zero they were both in fast food. When the foot traffic slowed in the Appalachian town that they lived in, they had been without work for 3 months. Of course, it was the winter, and no one's going to give you a job in that area in the winter. They were on the verge of getting evicted. In fact, Travis is standing at the window waiting for the sheriff's deputy to arrive, you know, with the eviction notice as we were talking to him. And Luke says, you know, Travis, why don't you go get Tanif? And Travis says, what's that? You know, similarly, Madonna Harris in Chicago tells me, she and her daughter have been homeless for months. She tells me they just aren't giving that out anymore. So when more and more people have fewer and fewer people in their networks who have ever received TANF, and they know more and more people who were turned down, you know, a case where, in fact, Ray McCormick finally did go to TANF. She's from Cleveland, and her caseworker, you know, reportedly told her, honey, sorry, there's not enough money to go around. You better come back next year. And, of course, the state of Ohio was sitting on about $1 million, according to my research, in a TANF surplus in that year that was going unspent. So for all these reasons, TANF has really died in the imaginations of the poor. When times get tough, people literally don't think of TANF anymore. And if you go around and ask social service providers around the country about TANF, they'll tell you, hey, we've given up on TANF. Nobody can get on it. We don't even send our clients over there anymore. So, you know, my friends in Cleveland, I've now been touring the country, you know, speaking about the book, and I've met all these amazing people in the charitable sector. And literally, TANF has disappeared from their imaginations as well because it's become such a shadow of its former self.
And so, wait. So, is that the primary element driving the rolls down, or is that in some way? I imagine it's sort of like an invirtuous circle, I guess, on some level or cycle, in that that the state doesn't advertise, it doesn't do any outreach, it also it also cuts the funding. And there's just this sort of rolling, I guess, momentum to the dissolution of the program.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's very much the case. But if you think of it, there are 1 million adults on the rolls right now. Okay, half of them are in California and New York. Right, New York is just such a poor, popular state, and California is the only state that's really tried to maintain, you know, sort of a functional TANF system. There's a few other virtuous states I should mention, Oregon, Minnesota, Vermont, but for the most part, it's been a race to the bottom to an extreme degree. But we have, you know, so you got 500 TANF adults in those states. And for the rest of the country, you only have, you know, 500,000 people. And they're scattered, right? They're scattered about. And the information flows that help people find out about programs just becomes atrophied. But there's one more piece to it I should mention to you. One thing welfare reform writ large, that means both these tax credits and the changing of the formula that made work pay, did is it really gave a lot of single mothers a taste for work. You know, back in the early 90s, women were still thinking, gee, you know, it's a cultural change, right? Women were still thinking, gee, if I go to work, am I going to be able to be a good mom? Well, women aren't thinking that anymore, for better or worse, right? Maybe we should be thinking about it for 1 and 2 year olds. I think the research actually suggests that. But women don't think that way. They think, gee, you know, if you ask poor women now about work, they say, well, I have to work because I can't model the value of education in my children. Good parents work.
But
that cultural change was very important, and the single mothers loved working. So now they think of themselves as workers, and their sense of shame about having to sort of sacrifice that identity to get on a welfare program, that's also a factor.
But is that a function of welfare reform or like a broader structural change in society? I mean, you know, yeah. I remember Dan Quayle, just 3 or 4 years before a welfare reform, you know, actually attacking Murphy Brown, who was
right.
a professional woman making a lot of money, you know, for doing something like that. And, you know,
yeah.
You know, the sort of the whitest woman in the country, essentially. And,
right.
You know, I mean, she, Candace Bergen was a movie star type of person, and saying that, like, literally she as an actress should be embarrassed for projecting that. I mean, it seems to me there was a broader cultural change that happened too over that time.
That's correct. That's right. Yeah. So there was a cultural change, and then, you know, so many single mothers did go to work in the 1990s. So, you know, we should give that's good, I think. But that was good that we made work pay and people took advantage of that and went to work in droves. But, you know, work turned out to be something they not only liked, but they began to get a deep sense of meaning from work. You know, it's really interesting. I wrote a book prior to $2 a Day on the earned income tax credit. So I hung out at H&R Block where most people get their tax refund. And, you know, these tax credits come with your tax refund. And so you have these low-wage workers getting these tax refunds of, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 when they're making maybe $15,000
right.
a year. You know, it's a big deal. And, you know, they say these amazing things like, I'm a real American. I work, therefore I'm a real American. One woman said to me, I am so proud to be a taxpayer. You know, I don't say this, but I don't feel proud to be a taxpayer. I pay a lot of taxes, but I'm, you know, it's not something I think about as a source of pride. But I think women, this cultural change for women has meant that they're judged a lot more like men are. You know, citizenship is work in America. You are what you produce in the workplace. You know, more than anything, the families we talk to across the country who are living in this desperate poverty, when we asked them what they wanted more of, no one said more handouts. To a person, they said more work, but more fundamentally, you know, they were all trying to work. They were hanging out to the ragged edge of this badly degraded low-wage labor market, working a little bit of the year, not working and being in utter destitution the rest of the year. But more than anything, what they wanted was to belong and to contribute. And they saw work as critical to this. So, you know, in the book, we do advocate for a work opportunity, a dramatically expanded work opportunity, just last week, William Crystal agreed with us. I mean, I think we still need a safety net. You know, we need something that catches families when they fall, because work won't always work. But, you know,
How does that work from a practical level? I mean, so if the economy isn't, if the private sector isn't creating jobs, and in many instances, you know, I guess the earned income tax credit theoretically is supposed to make up for this. I mean, we're seeing, you know, there's a significant revolt amongst low wage workers because they're not getting a living wage. How do you create work? I mean, is this how does that happen? How does more work opportunities happen if the private sector isn't creating them?
So it's a moral imperative that we do it. If we're telling people, we're only going to assist you if you work, and we're going to, you know, Paul Ryan wants to put work requirements into food stamps and other programs. We got to have work.
Right.
And we don't have work.
If that's the agenda.
We don't have enough.
Right? I mean, if it's not an agenda just to cut the rolls, that's what you need to do.
Right. And at least, you know, in word, the goal is to get people to work. So, okay, let's take that seriously. Right now, we're only spending 8% of our federal block grant dollars on work promoting activities. That's, you know, as my daughter would say, that's dead. We've got to do better. But I think there are three approaches that we can think about. Number one, we tried this during the recession. We saw some success. We can subsidize work and get employers to create new jobs. I think the best programs work when you surround these workers with some supports. In the book, we talk about a Bree McCormick, a woman who is a stable worker, two-time employee of the month, you know, at Walmart, because she's memorized all the barcodes on the produce items by reading them into her recording device on her phone and then playing it all night, continuous play as she sleeps and letting her subconscious, you know, do the job. And she loves work, but one day, you know, this car she shares with this extended group of loosely affiliated individuals she's sort of shacked up with, has no gas. She can't make it to work. And she is summarily dismissed because, of course, there are 100 other people with less complicated lives standing in line to have that cashier's job at Walmart. So, you know, we need to sort of, and in fact, this is in the president's budget for 2017, you know, what we colloquially call the Ray McCormick plan, an emergency assistance kind of plan that can help people with these one-term crises that can prevent a spiral into poverty. So, but in any case, we can stimulate more jobs in the private sector and actually provide supports to those workers, so they're going to show up and be good workers, and it's going to be good for the employer. And it's probably an and or, because the scope of the problem is big. We need to think about all the work that the market won't create, right? If you look around America, there's so much work that needs to be done. We don't have enough teachers in our classrooms. Our streets are full of trash. Our parks don't have enough rangers. They can't stay open for as many hours as they would like. They're improperly maintained. Our pools and recreation centers sit closed and empty because the cities can't afford to open them. Our public libraries have truncated hours, even when poor families are more and more reliant on them as a place to go, use the internet, find a quiet place, a shelter from the storm. So our infrastructure is crumbling. There is no shortage of work to be done, and as our economy, the American worker has been enormously productive. But
and we should say that coming out of just about every recession in the past 30 or 40 years, we saw a big bump in government workers, and we are somewhere, I don't know, 1.2 million workers behind where I think we were at this point in terms of coming out of a recession during George W. Bush and during Bush number one, and I think Reagan and then Clinton. I mean, we saw bumps in government workers, and where we saw it go the other direction under the Obama administration. That just briefly touch on, I mean, if those are the solution, one other thing I just wanted to briefly touch on was the notion that to contrast AFDC with an automatic stabilizer like food stamps. We saw food stamps, it seems to me, and we continue to be a way in which the states sort of supplement the AFDC. So in other words, they take TANF and they basically loot that money on some level, and then will shift the burden over to food stamps to the extent that it covers, because that's not block granted, and that comes directly from the federal government.
Yeah. So for every dollar, you know, for every dollar you lose in benefits, you're going to get about 25, 30 cents more in food stamps. So certainly food stamps is bearing some of this burden. And part of the reason you're seeing the rolls go up and the expenditure levels go up is because of the very thing that you're talking about. You know, what's really striking about food stamps, though, is we really should have realized something was going wrong at the bottom when looking at those data. So in 1996, we had 300,000 food stamp recipients who were applying or were certifying. These are households, right? That said they had zero cash income. That number was $1.3 million in 2013. So, it's kind of profound, right?
Right.
This is, more than a quadrupling in the food stamp program. But there are, you need to think about the charitable sector as well. They're bearing more and more of the burden. Of these families, so it's the families are falling apart and kids are ending up in child welfare. Two of our kids ended up in psychiatric care after breakdowns. Both of them having repeat spells in homeless shelters, which are really tough places for kids. So the costs are showing up. And the next step in this research is to really look very systematically at what these different levels of poverty mean for child development and health. Because you can put a price tag on health. And the hypothesis is that when you let people fall, and we may be wrong, right? We're scientists, and so we have to allow for that possibility. And we're committed to whatever answer the data shows. But it is possible that by letting families with children sink so low without a floor, we may be creating a very expensive proposition, even in the near term, but especially intergenerationally.
I mean, what is that? I realize this is sort of a thesis, but what would that? How would that cost manifest itself? That you're exponentially creating more cost to society by almost, I mean, it's a little bit crass, but like if I don't provide regular service for my car, I could be facing a much bigger problem.
Yeah, so we've been teaming up with pediatricians at Johns Hopkins Medical School, amazing group of women, I should say, who were identifying in various ways, both sort of, families right at the poverty level, and then families at 100% of poverty, and then families that are below 25%, and then, families at about 150%. And we're measuring child health, cognitive development, and brain development. So you can sort of spin out from that a set of cost estimates just to our healthcare system, because we, the correlates of what you see in terms of the cost to our healthcare system, and you can't sort of perhaps through this method you won't be able to document all of the cost to society, but you know, health is very expensive. It's one of our, it is our big ticket item in terms of, domestic spending. So if we can at least measure what this is going to cost us in the health domain, then we can make a much better argument about where the investments ought to be and what the payoff to those investments might be.
Right. Aside from just the simple moral argument that we shouldn't let people live like this and suffer in this way. Catherine Eden, the book is $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. We'll link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It was delightful to talk with you.